From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. We are now about a month shy of Election Day for the congressional midterm elections. Nevertheless, absentee ballots and those who have decided to vote by mail in many states have already received their ballots. The outcome in individual contests will decide who controls the House and the Senate, which in turn will drive the legislative agenda for the Congress, the White House, as well as the National Association of Postal Supervisors. It is important for those who care about the future of our families, our communities, the Postal Service, and most importantly, our nation, not squander the opportunity, the privilege, no, the obligation, to play an active role in our democracy. Now let's talk about this week's podcast. Besides pay, retirement and health care are the two key elements of federal and postal compensation. So I'd like to talk about retirement issues and the recently announced Federal Employees Health Benefits Program premiums with a good friend and colleague, John Hatton, Staff Vice President for Policy and Programs at the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees. This is not the first time John has been a guest on our podcast. John brings a wealth of knowledge to issues confronting the federal and postal community. In addition to his NARF responsibilities, John co-chairs the Legislative Committee of the Federal and Postal Coalition. He has been working for NARF's legislative operations for the past 12 years. Welcome back to Naps Chat, John.
Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate you having me on, and look forward to the conversation.
Now, John, many of the issues that we confront together are challenging and I might add, frustrating. Mm-hmm. I think that none is more vexing than our attempts to repeal the government pension offset and the windfall elimination provision. Both discriminatory policies financially harm civil service retirement system annuitants. The government pension offset dates back to 1977, and WEP was enacted in 1983. Yeah. About how many folks are affected by WEP and GPO?
All told, it's probably around 2 million. GPO, I think, is a little bit under a million, and WEP is a little bit over a million. And so it's not just those CSRS retirees. It's also a lot of state and local government retirees, depending on which state they're in and whether they are covered through their work for the state or local government through Social Security. So states like Texas, California, Ohio, Massachusetts, Illinois are some big states that we have allies in the state and local government community.
So this has been percolating almost 40 years, mm-hmm. trying to repeal these two statutes. Before we talk about activities that have been going on this year, with this tremendous constituency in favor of repeal, as you said, state, locals, right. as well as the federal governments, why have we been grappling with these two issues for almost 40 years?
It's a good question, and we've had success in the past, even before my time here at NARF, building a number of co-sponsors and showing support, but it's really never gotten through the committee process. And I think the policy reasons are, I think primarily is the cost to Social Security of repealing both of these things. They were both part of kind of compromises to help shore up Social Security back in the early 80s, and so kind of repealing them when Social Security is looking at solvency challenges in the early 2030s, creates even more of a problem there. So just the overall cost of it has an issue. Then there are rationales that you're trying to apply policies of Social Security to this group of people. Now, my argument is that it's a different system and you shouldn't kind of treat them discriminatorily because you have a pension in a different system. But those are the two kind of main arguments, I think, that face us. Going into this Congress, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, there were a few new rules in the House that allowed us to have a little bit more success pushing and enforcing some type of action, even if it's not as far as we've liked to get so far.
Yeah, let's talk about, before we talk about the policy, let's talk about the process.
Yeah.
Because everyone has been focusing on the so-called discharge petition, which required 290 individuals to sign a petition to get the bill out of committee. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so starting in really 2019 in the 116th Congress, they created something called the House Consensus Calendar. And this was something that a kind of group of both moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats pushed leadership to adopt. And under those rules, if you get 290 co-sponsors for a bill, you can file a motion to be on the House Consensus Calendar. If you have those 290 for 25 days and committee did not act, and that was a key portion, and the committee did not act on the bill, then you'd be placed on the consensus calendar and be in line for an actual floor vote. So we got to that 290 number in July 15th. The 25 days were about to hit September 19th. So we were slated to potentially get a House floor vote in the end of September. But what happened was the House Ways and Means Committee decided to mark the bill up and advance it out of committee, which took it off that calendar. And so we're now back to the place of trying to push for action. But getting committee action at all is further than we've ever gotten before. So we see that as a big success, even if there was a little bit of a downside to that action in that it prevented a floor vote.
Let's talk about the legislation for which the Ways and Means Committee actually marked up or reported to the floor without recommendation.
Right.
And I underscore without recommendation. The bill, H.R. 82, was introduced by Representatives Rodney Davis and Abigail Spanberger. I think the count currently is 303 co-sponsors. Mm-hmm. That represents about 70% of the House membership. As you indicated, this affects around 2 million Social Security recipients who also participate in either the civil service retirement system or a state and local retirement system. So as demonstrated by the sheer number of co-sponsors and the number of folks, the committee felt sort of compelled to move the bill so there wouldn't be an immediate vote on the floor. So where does that leave us right now?
Well, I think if you listened to the committee hearing, you actually heard a lot of positive remarks that everybody that talked wanted to do something on this issue. And some people were okay saying they support repeal, but really listening to the chairman and the ranking member, Neal and Brady, they gave the reasons why they didn't support repeal, but they both have bills to reform at least the windfall elimination provision. And so maybe they're not quite there on GPO, even if they want to address it. But I think what they said is they're trying to work towards an agreement between the two of them. Now, that wouldn't be full repeal, but it would be something. And so we'll see if that was just somewhat lip service or if they are really working towards it. I think they are legitimately and genuinely trying to find an agreement. Doesn't mean they're going to come together from the two sides of where they are on the bill. But I do think there is some hope. But in terms of a repeal vote on the floor, I think that the chances of that at this point for this Congress are still a bit low.
One of the things that really sort of boggles the mind is that when these provisions, WEP and GPO, were initiated back in the late 70s, early 80s, it was an agreement between then chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, amongst others, and at that time, President Ronald Reagan, to so-called shore up Social Security at the expense of folks who receive public service pensions. And we see it as, or actually the Congressional Budget Office and the Social Security Administration see it as a hit against the trust, Social Security Trust Fund. Maybe we should look at it as a hit against the civil, people who benefit from public pension, because they say Congressional Budget Office is estimating the cost of enacting repeal at $182 billion over 10 years, which is considerably more than what the Social Security Administration actually estimates, which is $146 billion over 10 years. So maybe we flip it a little bit and say, no, this isn't a cost to Social Security, but it's an actual hit against the people who are being basically screwed.
No, I absolutely agree. And we heard that from Rodney Davis, from Abigail Spanberger, that, this is disincentivizing public service and we are penalizing people for that public service, which is not the type of policy we want to do. And, you know, I think when you're looking at this, we're always faced with this status quo bias on any law that's on the books. Instead of people taking a fresh look at it and thinking, what is the right way to address these issues? They're like, well, if we make any change, it's going to cost us a lot of money. But that assumes that the policy was right to begin with. And so you're always faced with that challenge and changing anything after the fact and the difficulty of getting things through both the House, the Senate with their 60-vote threshold, and the presidency. So,
as we both know, with regard to the Postal Service, the requirement that the Postal Service pre-fund its future retiree health benefits, which was done in 2006, took years and years of action, and it was a bad policy at that time. And the reason why it was so difficult to sort of address that was because of the so-called cost.
Right, right.
So although there are different issues, it's the same type of, I guess, disincentive to solve problems that existed with the Postal Service reform issue.
Right, right. Yeah, it just goes to the thing. Once something is in law, it's really hard to take it out. So it's always good to get things written in stone.
And sometimes, sometimes it's good not to make a policy.
Right.
Let's talk about the windfall elimination provision fix, which could come up during a lame duck session. We do know that currently the House of Representatives is in recess, at least through the election, unless something extraordinary happens between now and then. What is the probability of WEP being addressed during that lame duck session?
Well, I don't want to put a number on it. I think there is a chance. I do think, like I said, I think there is genuine negotiation and discussion. What was difficult for me at the hearing was that there was this push on repeal, forced them to have the hearing, and they haven't really seemed to move anywhere different than where they were at the very beginning of the Congress, really a year and a half ago. So that is my pessimistic take, is they actually haven't moved at all, even though they say they're trying to get an agreement. My optimistic take is that this is becoming untenable for them to have this many people supporting the bill and not take further action, that they start to realize that the timing of doing it maybe in September wasn't as good as doing it after the election, if they're going to, for example, put it in a year-end tax extenders package. And I was told that they are talking to the Social Security actuary. So it sounds like they are looking at different options. The Neal and Brady constructs are very similar. Both would provide some relief for current retirees and apply a new formula going forward for future retirees. The only real difference between the two is that at some point in the future, the Brady bill says you only get that new formula, whereas the Neal bill provides this hold harmless provision where you get the better of the old or the new, basically forever. And so that changes the cost on the bill. It changes kind of the idea that they're shifting fully to this new formula. And so those two things, while they seem small, are kind of big in terms of bridging that gap.
Before I forget, for those of one who want to listen to the actual markup,
right,
they can go to the House Ways and Means website, and it's posted there, and that's www.house.gov, and then you just click on the Ways and Means Committee site, and you could listen. That would be interesting.
I actually found the hearing very interesting, and I listened to a lot of these, and there's usually a lot of kind of back and forth partisanship, and this was one where there was a lot of bipartisanship about trying to get to a deal, some actually what I thought were heartfelt sentiments expressed by members of Congress, somebody who's mom was affected, and things like that. So I actually thought it was an interesting hearing to listen to.
Yeah, John, another issue that concerns all federal and postal retirees is the magnitude of the anticipated 2023 civil service retirement system and federal employees retirement system cost of living adjustment. The retiree COLA is based on the increase of the consumer price index for urban wage earners, the so-called CPIW, from third quarter to third quarter. That would be from 2021 to 2022. Within recent history, the 2022 CPI was 5.9%. The previous year was about 1.3%. When should we expect the numbers to be released for the 2023 COLA? And do we have any idea what that number is going to be?
Yeah. So the final number to set the COLA will be released next Thursday morning. I don't know when this is going to air, but Thursday, October 13th in the morning, that'll be released. And so that'll just be a quick calculation by Social Security to put out the numbers. We do our own calculations too, but we like to check the Social Security numbers as well. So sometime in the morning of the 13th, that'll be finalized. And tracking the COLA, which we do on our website, the last COLA number for August was 8.65%, but against the third quarter average. So the July figure for the annual change was 8.87%. Looking at some projections, like the Cleveland Fed has a nowcast of potential inflation. It looks like it might go up 0.3% based on that. If you add all those numbers up, you're probably looking somewhere around 8.8. Now, it could be a little bit less, could be a little bit more, but it's probably in that range within, I would say, about 0.5% up or down of what the COLA would be for CSRS and Social Security. Now, FERS gets 1% less than that because law says if it's over 2%, it's over 3%, you get 1% less.
Let's talk about that difference, okay, John?
Yeah.
Congressman Jerry Connolly and Senator Padilla from California have legislation to equalize the treatment of both CSRS and FERS, cost of living adjustments. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple fix. It just says you get whatever the change in consumer price index says, whichever index you're going to use. FERS does not get some reduction. Now, this was all part of the balance shifting between CSRS and FERS, but the purpose of a cost of living adjustment is to make sure the value of that annuity is keeping up with the changing cost of living. And if it's less than whatever that changing cost of living is that you're measuring, then it's just not going to be adequate for that purpose. So again, another policy that when put in place, I think was wrongly decided. We're trying to fix it now. Good news is this year we have a bill that was introduced in the Senate that was not previously done. We're getting a little bit more on the co-sponsors than we've had in the past, but it's still a pretty long way to go. Obviously, inflation being high is certainly going to elevate this issue, maybe give it a little bit more attention. But in terms of gaining the support in Congress, we still have a while to go.
Yeah, the reason why a lot of folks who do not support equitable treatment indicate that they get the COLA through the Social Security, and as such, they shouldn't get a FERS. But that denies the fact that when FERS was created, it was supposed to replicate CSRS,
right,
which had a full COLA. So it's sort of, again, ironic that whatever policy was determined back in 1983 to create FERS is harmful financially to retirees, in this case, FERS retirees.
Right. Yeah, and the FERS annuity is half, essentially, of what the CSRS annuity is. And so it has to combine with Social Security. So if you're not getting the full COLA on that half of your retirement income, then you're not going to be as good off, as well off.
And if people think that the TSP makes up the difference, just look at your portfolio these days, and you'll notice it's not. If you're retiring this year, it may not be a good idea to bank on your TSP account.
Yeah, unfortunately, the market's been very up and down recently. So,
another issue with regard to cost of living adjustments is that, as I referenced, the cost of living adjustment is based on the CPIW, that is for urban wage earners.
Right.
I know that a lot of us have been arguing for replacing the index by which cost of living adjustments are calibrated, and that would be a CPI for retirees, a CPIE, I believe it's called.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the CPIE would measure prices experienced by those 62 and older as opposed to that smaller subset. Now, I think the only reason they're using that CPIW is because that was what was in place being calculated when automatic cost of living adjustments went into effect in the 70s. But it doesn't make a lot of sense if you're trying to, again, make sure that the value of your Social Security benefits or your annuity are keeping up with inflation to be measuring inflation for a subset of people that is not you. So the people who rely on the cost of living adjustments are retirees, so we should measure how they're experiencing prices. And the difference that the CPIE does, and now it may not seem like a lot, it's a 0.2 to 0.3% difference over time annually, but that compounds a lot over the course of a 30-year retirement. And so, you know, if things like healthcare costs are going up at a higher rate than other inflation, then the CPIE takes that into account. So things, again, that seniors are paying more for and seeing higher inflation on aren't properly accounted for in the current formula.
What people need to understand is when you calculate a consumer price index, you're looking at a market basket.
Yeah.
Like what you put in the basket
when
you go shopping. Folks in the 20 to, let's say, 55 age range are buying different types of products than people who are 55 and over.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of their market basket that might include healthcare products for the younger population is considerably less than for the older population, and educational costs, conversely.
Right.
So you don't capture those increases as accurately for the different populations. So the CPIE is more customized for the retiree population.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think things like healthcare, the retiree population probably spends 12%, I think, was the latest stats I saw, of their income on healthcare, where it's the younger population, it's 5 or 6%. So that really makes a difference.
Which brings me to our next issue. Mm-hmm. Federal Employees Health Benefits Program premium increases. I had seen that, and I'm going to focus on the OPM is focusing on the average increase of 7.2% increase of premium. But I want to focus on the 8.7% average increase that will be borne by participants in FEHB, because that's what comes out of our pockets, not necessarily the overall premium. It's the early contribution. 8.7% sort of eats up that cost of living adjustment.
Yeah, it certainly does eat up a portion of it. Now, if your annuity is larger on gross than the amount you're paying for your premiums, you're still going to be better off. But you're also seeing increasing prices in a lot of other goods and services. So you have to take it all into account. So that 8.7% might be right in range with the whatever the cost of living adjustment is. And so, yeah, it's that portion of that part of your budget goes directly to that increase in FEHB premium. So it's going to hurt you. You know, I think the one thing we always encourage our members to do is to shop plans, right? At the end of the day, the average increase sometimes is a little bit less because people look at their plans and they say, well, maybe I don't need this more comprehensive plan. Maybe I can coordinate and find a different one. And so we always encourage people to take a look, especially when premiums are so high.
The argument or the justification that OPM is raising for the increase in premium is a lot of folks who have deferred elective procedures during the pandemic or during this past year, and they project will use those elective procedures.
Yeah.
So that is driving the cost. I'm not as convinced that prescription drug medication costs have gone up, because usually that is the driver. But and I'm just going to say that in Medicare Part B, monthly premiums are going down because the projected cost for prescription drug medication, particularly the drug that is now treating Alzheimer's disease, is not as costly as projected.
Right.
So it's sort of counterintuitive that if you have Medicare Part B premiums going down and FEHBP premiums going up.
Right. No, it's very interesting to see that. And I was a little bit surprised by the high premium increase after seeing the Medicare premium numbers going down. But yeah, the explanations, OPM always provides a number of factors that affect the premium increases, and the increased utilization makes some intuitive sense that people weren't going to the hospital during the pandemic and now they are, or they're getting elective procedures. So it's obviously not great to see that high premium increase. It's somewhat in line with other large employer premiums, so it's not like OPM is necessarily doing a bad job doing this. This is just what the overall marketplace is doing.
You were talking about strategies to sort of mitigate the impact of the premium increase by shopping around during the upcoming open season, which starts, I believe, the second week in November, goes through December. One of the other strategies, particularly for retirees who might be Medicare eligible, is shop for those plans that give premium refunds for Part B. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's an increasing number of plans that will provide some type of reimbursement amount for your Part B premiums. So if you have Medicare, that's certainly a good idea to take a look at those. There's also some coordination with these kind of new Medicare Advantage add-ons for a lot of plans where, you know, they're even more tailored to Medicare enrollment by adding on this kind of additional Medicare Advantage plan to the FEHB plan. And so there's a number of plans. OPM always in its call letter always encourages improved coordination with Medicare. A lot of plans, and not every single plan, will cover your copays and out-of-pocket costs if you have both. And so that's why a lot of people make the choice to take Part B. And so certainly looking at how those plans coordinate is something we always recommend. different people have different decision making on whether to take Part B, but if you do, certainly take a look at your FEHB plans. You might be able to have a lower cost plan combined with that. Take a look at which plans coordinate best with Medicare.
I should just mention that in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a representative from the Office of Personnel Management on our podcast, NAPS Chat, to talk about this issue as well as the premium increase and issues about benefit changes that are occurring for the 2023 contract year. Last issue I'd like to talk about is a problem that a lot of folks who did the responsible thing a number of years ago, and that was enrolled in federal long-term care insurance. The premiums are blowing out of the water. They're increasing astronomically. And so less and less people are participating, and folks are really concerned. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So the federal long-term care insurance program started out and provided premium quotes that, had language says they're not guaranteed, but they were intended to be stable over the life of your insurance, over basically your life. So you're putting all this money away each month to prepare for these future costs. This program has been on 7-year contracts with the insurer. So the first time it came up for renewal, they took a look at the numbers and said, we need to increase premiums. At that time, it was 25%. That actually came as a shock to a lot of people who thought their premiums were stable. If it was 25% every 7 years, we'd be pretty happy to have that at this point. The next time, they went up as high as 126%. They are now in the process of renewing the contract. They put it out for bid. There's only the same John Hancock bidder again, so there's no competition for it. They have expressed an intent to renew the contract. They are finalizing premium numbers that will come out next year. Enrollees have received letters saying that they are going to see premium increases. We don't know that number yet, but we expect it to be very high. For people who have planned a certain amount for this cost over the life, they're getting hit with completely unexpected numbers on what they're going to have to pay out of pocket, maybe unaffordable completely for them to do that. They have no choice as to whether to really pull out because they're losing all the money they've paid in. And so OPM may provide some options where you reduce your coverage and you keep your premiums the same. That is still a loss for them. And it's a really frustrating experience where this program was set up where all the risk of the insurance company getting the assumptions wrong has been on the enrollee losing coverage or paying more in premiums. And we've expressed our frustration with that. We've asked OPM if they would take a look at a partial refund option. The answer we got was no. In my view, all the risk is at the tail end. So you've paid in more at this point than you might have than the value that you've gotten thus far, but you're locked in because you need that money to pay for these future costs. So it's a problem. I think the program has not been designed the right way from the start. So
with that, John, I want to thank you for joining us today on NAPSChat. This has been John Hatton, Staff Vice President of the National Association of Retired and Federal Employees.
Thank you.
And I want to thank NAPSChat listeners for logging on today. If you enjoy NAPSChat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NAPSChat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.